Turkey's held talks with Russia, seeking a way to create a grain corridor to ease the stress on the global food supply.
Following Wednesday's talks, Çavuşoğlu said the UN-backed plan was reasonable, but added both Russia and Ukraine would have to agree to it.
Plus, Russia has long been concerned about NATO's expansion, but what's shaping Moscow's policies in the Arctic and Antarctic?
Perceptions tend to become a reality when you shape your own narrative, your own self-mythology for so long that you end up believing in your own lies.
And later in the program, what's the risk of additional Russian cyber attacks on the U.S.? Today is Wednesday, June 8th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Miller. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on Wednesday said the onus was on Ukraine to solve the problem of resuming grain shipments by demining its ports. Lavrov made the comments in Ankara, where he met with Turkish officials to resolve the issue, adding that Moscow has already fulfilled its necessary commitments. Reuters reporter Louisa Knox starts us off.
Ukraine is one of the world's biggest exporters of grain. Western countries have accused Russia of creating a risk of global famine by shutting the country's Black Sea ports. Moscow denies responsibility for the crisis, putting the blame on Western sanctions. The United Nations have appealed to both sides, as well as maritime neighbour and NATO member Turkey, to agree a corridor for exports to be resumed.
Biz Türkiye olarak bu planı...
Following Wednesday's talks, Çavuşoğlu said the UN-backed plan was reasonable, but added both Russia and Ukraine would have to agree to it. Any deal could involve a Turkish naval escort for tankers leaving Odessa and other Ukrainian ports, which are currently blockaded by Russia's navy, and onward to Turkey's straits and global markets.
Louisa Knox of Reuters News. Ukraine reacted negatively to the comments coming out of Ankara. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv has the Ukrainian reaction.
Before this meeting, Ukrainian officials and President Zelensky in particular said that Ukraine would definitely not want this issue to be solved through easing sanctions or removing sanctions, meaning that sanctions that Russia is receiving is not something which is, you know, concerning grain. It's something that concerning wars that Russia started. There is already an official reaction from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which is basically the following. Ukrainian Ministry of Foreign Affairs emphasizes that it's quite difficult, you know, to believe to any so-called guarantees that Russia is giving, especially considering that this country started an unprovoked full-scale war against Ukraine. And, of course, Ukraine can be sure that Russia will not attack the south of Ukraine by using these grain export corridors. And this is very important to, you know, keep in mind. And this is a crucial point for Ukraine. So Ukraine wants guarantees from third countries, from the partners and all the organizations which will be involved in this export corridors, green corridors for grain to be made, because Ukraine is afraid that Russia could use this for another assault. I would quote the what exactly the spokesperson of the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Ukraine said. Quote, Lavrov's words are empty. Ukraine has clearly stated its position on seaports. Military equipment is needed to protect the coastline and a Navy mission is needed to patrol export routes in the Black Sea. End of quote.
That was Anna Chernikova reporting from Kyiv, Ukraine. Russia has drawn closer to its goal of fully capturing Ukraine's eastern industrial heartland of coal mines and factories, as the Kremlin claimed to have taken control of 97% of one of the two provinces that make up the Donbass region. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma is up next.
Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu says Moscow's forces hold nearly all of Luhansk province, and it appears that Russia now occupies roughly half of Donetsk province, according to Ukrainian officials and military analysts. While Russia has superior firepower, Ukrainian defenders are entrenched and have shown the ability to counterattack. On Tuesday, President Volodymyr Zelensky said Russian forces had made no significant advances in the eastern Donbas region over the past day. Norway is upping arms shipments to Ukraine in its fight against Russia. Norway's defense minister says the government is donating heavy artillery with equipment, spare parts and munitions to Ukraine, enabling the country to, he says, withstand the Russian attacks, framing the offer as a substantial contribution. The Scandinavian country's armed forces recently has replaced M109 artillery guns with new artillery from South Korea, with 22 of the munitions going to Ukraine. Norway adds that it's also trained Ukrainian forces to operate the guns in Germany. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The war in Ukraine and COVID-19's continued fallout delivered more grim economic news on Wednesday, with the Paris-based Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development sharply lowering its global growth forecast and predicting rising inflation. Lisa Bryant reports that the poorest people and countries may suffer the most.
The OECD slashed its global growth forecast to 3% this year, down from 4.5% the organization predicted only a few months ago. It estimates growth will slow even further in 2023. The main culprit, Russia's invasion of Ukraine. OECD Secretary General Matthias Cormann.
As a result of Russia's war, global growth will be lower and inflation will be higher for longer. Both business investment and private consumption growth have been hit, and the war has further exacerbated supply chain disruptions, which had previously been brought on by the pandemic, which is pushing up energy and food prices and causing significant price volatility.
Representing 38 mostly developed countries, the OECD predicts the U.S. and Eurozone economies will grow by just 2.5% and 2.6% respectively this year, also down sharply from earlier forecasts. Even China, handicapped by zero COVID policies and vaccine shortages, will see its economy growing just 4.4% in 2022, compared to a previously forecasted 5.1%. Its slowdown is expected to put a further brake on global growth. But the OECD's chief economist, Laurence Boone, says the world's poorest countries are the biggest worry.
We're very concerned. About the food situation in low-income countries. The war is really sending shockwaves all the way to Africa and the Middle East.
Many of these countries depend on wheat from Ukraine and Russia to feed their people.
The war could spark starvation. It could cause social unrest and political turmoil.
The OECD's forecast follows equally dark global outlooks by both the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The Paris-based body advises a raft of measures to turn around the trajectory, including more aid to developing countries and more global cooperation. Also key, investing in green energy to end dependence on countries like Russia, a key exporter of fossil fuels. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
A leading human rights organization is calling on the United Nations Human Rights Council to appoint a special rapporteur to investigate and document human rights practices within Russia as the best way to curtail atrocities in Ukraine. Lisa Schlein has those details.
Human Rights Watch Executive Director Kenneth Roth is making the appeal in advance of the Council's four-week session, which begins next week. He says President Vladimir Putin's harsh crackdown on political dissent, heightened censorship and disinformation within Russia is designed to avert opposition to the war in Ukraine and the atrocities being committed there in the name of the Russian people. He says the appointment of a special rapporteur on the human rights situation in Russia would lift this veil of ignorance. He says Putin cares tremendously about the views of the Russian people, and his efforts to curtail free speech within the country are all geared toward reducing dissent.
You know, even though, you know, Putin is an autocrat, even though he sort of sits at the end of his, you know, COVID-induced isolation table, you know, seemingly making decisions on his own, he is attentive to Russian public opinion. And so therefore, kind of a more holistic approach to trying to address the atrocities in Ukraine would ensure that the Russian people are able to speak.
Turning to another issue, Roth says High Commissioner Michel Bachelet has missed a great opportunity to hold China to account for its mass incarceration of nearly 2 million Uyghurs in secretive detention camps in Xinjiang. He describes the High Commissioner's recent visit to China as an unmitigated disaster. He says she was skillfully played by Beijing and completely adopted Beijing's framework.
There was, you know, no condemnation from Madame Bachelet, even remotely commensurate with the severity of the atrocities being committed in Xinjiang. She never called them crimes against humanity. She never called them much of anything. She just, you know, was there for a discussion.
Bachelet has said her trip to China last month was intended as an opportunity to discuss human rights with senior officials and pave the way for continued talks. What right groups call internment camps, China calls educational and vocational centers. It denies that Uyghurs are involuntarily detained and mistreated. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and other organizations have raised serious concerns about the treatment of ethnic Uyghurs. Roth urges Bachelet to immediately issue her long-awaited report on China's crimes against humanity in Xinjiang. He says Beijing responds to pressure. He notes the High Commissioner has the power to exert public pressure to shame and condemn Beijing for what it is doing in Xinjiang. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Mathieu Boulegh is a senior research fellow in the Russia and Eurasia program at the International Affairs Group Chatham House in London. He recently wrote that, quote, Russia's policy for the polar regions overlapped and are increasingly becoming militarized as the perception of threats to Russian national interests grows, end quote. Boulegh is currently in New York, and I spoke to him not long ago to learn more about why Russia's concern about NATO encroachment provides the basis for their policies in the region.
So that's a really good question. So first of all, I would make the difference that what we see in the Arctic and the Antarctic as well, in terms of Russian foreign policy perceptions, is not necessarily polar specific and definitely not Arctic specific. In the sense that what we see there in terms of unfolding security dilemma, in terms of tension in the Arctic, is also informed by wider geopolitical considerations, namely the threat perception from the Kremlin that, yes, indeed, NATO is out there to get them, that, yes, indeed, the borders of the alliance have been expanded against Russia and so on. And the second point is that it is very much a perception, and perceptions tend to become a reality when you shape your own narrative, your own self-mythology for so long that you end up believing in your own lies, that you end up believing in your own vision of the world, that indeed does say for the past 30 years that Russian security interests have not been taken into consideration, that it's okay to use force and blunt force, as we see now after Russia's second invasion of Ukraine, to justify your foreign policy and to make a point that this is a form of reassertion. So there is a, you know, this whole ecosystem around Russian foreign policy perception that is really interesting. And what makes it uniquely Arctic or uniquely polar is the sense that there is a catching up moment for Russia, for the Kremlin, after leaving these regions sort of under the radar for the 90s, basically, for over a decade, that Russia needs to play catch up with what's happening in the region, needs to show that it is indeed a region of interest, not least because of the military potential, but also the economic potential in terms of development, but also in terms of infrastructure, and that Russia needs to defend this sort of new border in the north and defend its national security interest or its perceived national security interest in the south.
So I want to talk about the south because, as you mentioned, perceived national security interest in the north, the Russian Federation is very close to the Arctic. It's not necessarily close to the Antarctic, which is on a separate hemisphere. So why policy decisions affecting, you know, the southern polar cap?
So the Antarctic is a really interesting case, and this is why I wanted to, in this paper, to link them up and to try to look whether Russia was having a sort of comprehensive approach to both poles, right, in terms of what happens as above, so below. But it seems that the Antarctic is a completely different ballgame when it comes to security perceptions. There is still this willingness to protect the perceived national interest, which is a mix of great power politics, the symbolic presence of Russia in the mix, but also the fear of missing out, as I call it. The fact that if and when there are changes within the Antarctic Treaty System governance, within the structure itself of the ATS, the Antarctic Treaty System, then Russia wants to be ready to make sure its national interests are protected. And national interests there are really much about the prestige, the exploration, but also fishing, presence, and increasingly understood in terms of future economic development should there be a renegotiation around the ban on mining, the ban on energy exploration, and so on. So it is really much about anticipatory politics more than it is reactionary. So this is, you know, in as much as the Arctic is a place where Russia reacts to perceived encroachments from foreign nations, Antarctica is really a place where Russia tries to put itself into prospective thinking, to try to basically fight the future when the future comes biting.
So, Matthew, where do you see things going from here in terms of either consequences or policy recommendations for the international community, since there has been a fairly unified response since the latest Russian invasion that began in February, which is, of course, after the 2014 annexation of Crimea?
I think one of the main takeaway and the key takeaway from this paper is that we also need to try to understand increasingly in our global communities the linkages between the poles, between the Arctic and Antarctica. That's the first thing, that we can't isolate both poles because of geography, because of the impact of climate change and changing geopolitical environments. We need to think these things comprehensively, as above, so below, in a way. And then the key takeaway also in the Arctic is that we tend to be focused, whether it's at the level of European nations or even in the US regarding NATO as well, the place of NATO in the Arctic, we tend to look at these things specifically from the lens of the European Arctic, basically what happens north of the North Atlantic, close to the Arctic zone of the Russian Federation in the European Arctic. I argue that we need to have a software change concerning this analysis because Russia doesn't think like that. They think about the Arctic as a strategic continuum stretching from Europe to the Pacific with the North Pole in the middle, which means that if we want to have a more comprehensive understanding of what Russia is doing in the region, we also need to think like that. And we also need to adapt our processes, our policies, and our reactions to how Russia sees the world.
Matthew Buleg is a senior research fellow in the Russia and Eurasia program at the Chatham House, an international affairs think tank located in London. But I was speaking to him in New York. Matthew, thank you.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
The United States is the target of thousands of cyber attacks each day, many of them originating from Russia. If tensions between Washington and Moscow escalate further over the war in Ukraine, experts worry that Russian President Vladimir Putin will order a full-scale cyber attack that could devastate America's critical infrastructure. VOA's Igor Siganeka reports on the likelihood of such a scenario.
Swift and coordinated Western sanctions imposed on Moscow for its unprovoked attack on Ukraine left the Russian financial system in ruin. Angry at the United States for leading the unified response and supplying the Ukrainians with weapons, Russian President Vladimir Putin, some fear, may retaliate against Washington in the domain in which his country excels – cyber warfare. Congressman Mike Gallagher is a former Cyberspace Solarium Commission co-chair. If the situation escalates further, I think we are going to see Russian cyber attacks against our critical infrastructure. Gallagher's fears are shared by other experts like Nicholas Shalon, who served as a chief software officer at the U.S. Air Force until the fall of 2021.
Cyber can be even more scary than the traditional weapons.
But how well prepared is the United States for a possible cyber Armageddon? Well, it's complicated. Nicolas Chalon again.
The U.S. is kind of leading in cyber offense, so we have a very good capability. Our defense capabilities are pretty weak. I call them at the kindergarten level.
A successful French-born entrepreneur and coder, Nicolas Chalon, joined the U.S. government in 2016 to help fight cybercrime on the international level. Since then, he has grown disappointed in the government's ability to protect its cyber systems. The situation in some private companies that support America's critical infrastructure is not much better, he says.
So what you end up seeing is a lot of companies are making those systems accessible from the internet because they don't have enough experts to locally maintain them. So they have to send people remotely and virtually to go and connect to the systems. But effectively, that opens the door to massive cyber risks.
Chalon recalls the 2021 cyber attack on Colonial Pipeline, an American fuel transfer system which left half the U.S. East Coast without gas and affected the lives of millions for days.
We know there are plenty of instances where both China and Russia have been inside of U.S. systems for months, if not years. In fact, they're probably inside of many of the critical infrastructure systems right now as we speak.
Chalon says it's possible that Washington's geopolitical adversaries have already planted cyber tools into America's systems, tools that can be activated at a critical time in the future.
At the end of the day, this is really pretty scary. It's always funny how, you know, we are complacent.
Other experts say the impact of such cyber attacks, even those of a sweeping nature, will be limited by geography and infrastructure sectors affected. Jacob Galbraith is the head of strategy branch at NATO's Cooperative Cyber Defense Center of Excellence in Tallinn, Estonia.
I think the scope of the damage that could be done can be large but regional. We have a lot of overlap in a lot of these sectors. So if power is maybe affected in one region, there's some flexibility in the system for this.
Some people say that superpowers refrain from engaging in full-on cyber offensive exchanges because of the principle of mutual assured destruction, or MAD, which applies not only to potential nuclear confrontations, but also to cyber warfare. This principle of deterrence hinges on the notion that a cyber attack by one superpower against another would be met with an overwhelming response, leaving both countries devastated. Jacob Galbraith again.
They have to understand that our nation would respond.
Estonia was the first country to suffer a serious state-on-state cyber attack. In April of 2007, hackers, presumably with ties to the Kremlin, attacked websites belonging to the country's government, media, and financial institutions. The assailants used botnets, or networks of compromised devices connected to the internet. Thomas Hendrik Ilves was Estonia's president at the time.
Things have gotten much worse since then.
With the spread of internet technology, the number of web-connected devices increased. So did the potential for successful hackings. Thomas Hendrik Ilves.
For example, I mean, there are 500,000 closed-circuit TVs or CCTVs only in the city of London.
As computer technologies develop quickly, superpowers can only guess what kind of cyber-offensive tools their opponents have. But experts say the war in Ukraine may have offered a unique glimpse into Russia's true capabilities, shedding some light not only on Moscow's limits in conventional warfare, but also in cyber operations. Jacob Galbraith.
If you'd asked me 3 months ago, I probably would have given you a different answer. But right now, it looks like they could they need to spend a lot more time on defense. They're not doing very well.
One of the reasons why Russia is not doing so well, Galbraith says, is third-party involvement in the conflict.
For the scale, is quite impressive of how many other citizens of the world are being involved for or against Ukraine or Russia. In this aspect, I think the effect on Russia has been fairly devastating. People around the world that are definitely against what the Russian army is doing and what the Russian government is doing in Ukraine.
Experts say these regional war will have global implications and might reshape our understanding of the distribution of power, including in cyberspace. Igor Tikhonenko, VOA News, New York.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage, not only on Ukraine, but news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.